Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our series on corruption of Big Ag. My guests from the United Kingdom in London will be Professor Michael Antonio. He is an expert in molecular genetics and the head of the nuclear biology and the gene expression groups at King's College London School of Medicine, where he has been teaching since 1994. He is also a member of the school's Genetic Modification Safety Committee. In 2006, he was elected to the executive board of the British Society for Gene Therapy. He has been an international figure in the scientific community challenging the assumed safety of GMOs and genetic engineering. He is a co-author with Claire Robinson of a volume of scientific documentation and analysis debunking GMO myths entitled GMO Myths and Truths. And he has published many research papers in peer-reviewed journals. He attended University of Oxford and has a doctorate in biochemistry from the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. He later worked as a postdoctoral research fellow in the Tumor Biology Laboratory at the University of Nebraska. Joining him from London will be Claire Robinson. Claire is the research director of Earth Open Source, a nonprofit organization dedicated to assuring the sustainability and security and safety of the global food system. She has been a longtime food activist who has challenged the use of pesticides, artificial fertilizers, and genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, in agriculture based upon scientific grounds. She is also a managing editor and co-founder of GMO Watch in the United Kingdom, and also has been a leading advocate for having the truth about GMOs be presented to the American and worldwide public. You can download GMO Myths and Truths free at earthopensource.org and receive the latest information about GMOs and gmwatch.org. I'd like to welcome both of you to our program. Michael, we're going to begin with you. Big agriculture continues to fall back upon its doctrine of sustainable equivalence or substantial equivalence, meaning to the lay people that there's no difference between that which is a GMO based and that which is organic based or just regular farming. They're the same. And that's how they frame their argument that GMOs are no different than their natural non-GMO counterparts, and to continue with its claims that GMOs are safe to eat, don't threaten the environment. So go into some detail to share some of the more recent research that discredits the substantial equivalency theory and its suggestion that GMOs are not the same as non-GMOs and, in fact, pose potential serious risks to the health of humans and animals and to the environment. The forum is yours.
Thank you very much, Gary. It is a pleasure to be on this program. Indeed, you're absolutely right in that a major assertion to this day of the GM crop by technology industry advocates is on the equivalence of GM and non-GM, apart from the single or very few genes that you add to the GM crop, everything else is the same. And as a result, because you know the outcomes, you claim to know the outcomes of the introduced foreign GM gene units into the GM crop in their entirety, you're able to make a claim of equivalence apart from that change, intended change you've made. But this fundamentally ignores a number of issues about GMO crop technology that clearly shows that it is radically different from any other novel food, novel crop production system. The way in which a GMO crop is produced is through the artificial insertion of a totally artificial, again, gene unit, usually comprised of multiple components from multiple organisms, in an array that would simply never come together naturally in nature. And as a result, there is no there is no way you can claim that the combinations of genes that are produced through GM crop development is akin in any way to natural breeding. The dangers that arise, the potential dangers that arise from this technology, are from the fact you are bringing about combinations of genes that would not naturally occur, because in the majority of cases you are introducing genes into the crop from totally unrelated organisms, such as viruses and bacteria or unrelated plants or even animals. And the fact that the GM transformation process itself is what we call highly mutagenic. That is to say, it is generally disruptive on the DNA sequence and on gene function within the resulting GM crop. So these combinations of effects, the novel combinations of genes, and the general disruptive effect of the GM process leads to a disturbance in gene function, knocking on effects onto the biochemistry of the plant. And if you disturb the biochemistry of the plant, you run the risks of producing novel toxins and novel allergens, which can obviously affect the consumer in multiple ways. So this idea of equivalence of the two is scientifically unjustifiable. And this is why a company can claim that a GM crop is an invention and therefore patentable if the GM process was somehow a natural process and therefore did not involve any kind of inventive step. It would never be patentable, but it clearly isn't natural, and therefore they can claim it to be patentable. Now, following up from that, the research, there's an accumulating body of evidence over the years where you do a very thorough biochemical, very thorough molecular compositional analysis of a GM crop and a non-GM crop equivalent. And that analysis shows very dramatically that compositionally, in terms of the spectrum of proteins or the spectrum of small molecules, metabolites, nutrients, as well as the spectrum of gene function between the GM and the non-GM equivalent, are dramatically different. And therefore, based on this thorough molecular compositional analysis, which unfortunately is not required by regulators to be incorporated into the risk assessment of the GM crop, based on that, there is no way that you can claim that a GM and a non-GMO are substantially equivalent. In fact, far from it, they are dramatically different. And in terms of health risks that arise, there is indeed a increasing body of evidence in controlled laboratory animal feeding studies. And this includes studies conducted by the industry itself that show that the consumption of a GMO, when compared to the consumption of the non-GMO equivalent, shows clear signs of multiple organ toxicity in animals, particularly rats, which are the standard toxicity model system, the surrogate for human toxicity evaluation, that there are signs of toxicity to multiple organ systems and particularly to liver and kidney function. And in one case where a study was extended to 2 years, then these signs of toxicity to liver and kidney function at 90 days escalated, as shown in industry studies, escalated into severe illness leading to organ failure and premature death in those GMO-fed animals. So there is this these toxic effects or signs of toxicity at the very least that we're seeing to multiple organ systems. I mentioned liver and kidney function, but in addition, digestive problems are there, immune system disturbances are also there, blood system disturbances are there. Have also been observed. There are multiple potential sources. One is toxicity, the production of novel toxic or allergenic substances that have arisen directly from the GM transformation process, along the lines of what I mentioned earlier, the fact that the process is bringing about an altered biochemistry and composition to the GMO food. That's one potential reason why we're seeing these adverse health impacts in these controlled animal feeding studies. The other source of toxicity which cannot be ignored are the increased levels of exposure to pesticides, in particular glyphosate-based herbicides that are used in association with the vast majority of the GM cropping that is going on in the world right now. 80% of the GM crop cultivation in the world, including especially North and South America, is with glyphosate-resistant GM crops, which means automatically exposure to higher levels of residues of these pesticides in our food. That is also a clear potential source of toxicity, which over the medium to long term can give rise to serious ill health, as animal studies have indicated. So this is the spectrum of evidence that we have. It may not be 100% definitive, but it is very, very suggestive that there is something wrong with the GM food that is being produced. The animal studies show ill effects. I cannot tell you exactly what the cause of those ill effects are to these multiple organ systems. But the finger is pointing clearly to the GMO feed in these studies. And there are multiple elements there that can contribute to these toxic effects. So the evidence, even as it stands right now, is clearly showing that GMO foods and non-GMO foods are not equivalent, and indeed may pose serious health risks to the consumer.
Let's take it from there. What you're telling us is that the worldwide public has been exposed to a source of food, the GM-manufactured corn, for example, and soy and dairy, that have not been proven safe in humans or even animals, and because of their ability to maneuver through the political channels and the special interest channels of Congress, especially under Bush Sr. and each of the subsequent presidents, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, that there has been no major effort by the federal regulatory agencies, specifically three, the Food and Drug Administration, which oversees food safety, the CDC, which should be looking at any kind of possible causation or causality between what a person eats or consumes and any form of disease, the U.S. Public Health Service, which oversees everything, all those fall under it. And yet there is nothing being done. In fact, Monsanto, the leading purveyor of GMOs, has one of its former lawyers, Michael Taylor, now overseeing food safety at the FDA, but there are 17 other leading genetically modified executives who had come from DuPont, Syngenta, and Monsanto, who now occupy very powerful positions within the federal government. Would that be hence the American and world public are simply nothing more than human guinea pigs? Is that an accurate or inaccurate assessment?
The way I see it is that the evaluation of the health risks of GMOs in the United States in particular are totally inadequate. They are not in tune with the science. as it has unfolding and continues to unfold. And as a result, they are simply not doing their job properly, you could say. Here in Europe, we have a stricter system, but even here, again, we see major gaps in the health risk evaluation process of these products. And as a result, by not being true to the science, public safety is indeed being put at risk.
During the time period since GMOs first were introduced onto the world market for human consumption, we've witnessed a rapid decline in the quality of health in people, and particularly in children. Metabolic syndrome, which includes a panel of disorders such as obesity, increases in blood sugar and triglycerides, and GI problems, allergies, asthma, adult diabetes in children, and ADHD has become epidemic. Now, I'm not suggesting that by itself that GMOs have caused this, but I have to wonder at what level have they contributed. Hormonal imbalances due to the disturbance of the endocrine system is commonplace. Male sterility and female infertility are rising in young adults. However, there have been many other environmental factors that might contribute to these health findings, which big agriculture can point to and make the claim that it's not GMOs and pesticides contributing to their increase, and there are equally health risks in toxic chemicals in everyday household products, air pollution, over-vaccination of children, and many other toxic ingredients found in vaccines, chemicals and preservatives used in everyday processed foods. Are there certain studies now that show rather conclusively that GMO consumption and pesticides do in fact contribute to a certain increased risk of these illnesses?
I can say a few words about that.
All right, Claire.
First of all, it's extremely difficult to trace the escalating ill health problems, particularly in the U.S., to genetically modified food because the GM foods in the U.S. and Canada are not labeled. And even if they were labeled, there are no epidemiological studies being done to trace how much GM food people are potentially consuming and to link that to any health problems that we may see occurring. We do know that people's health in America is getting worse. We hear from some vets and farmers that livestock health is getting worse in the U.S., and now increasingly the same thing is being seen in Europe as well. As the percentage of GM feed goes up, so the health of the livestock tends to decline. And these are really worrying trends, and I think in any normal society, certainly if there was any suspicion that the factors that were causing the ill health rise were due to biological factors, infectious diseases, etc., I think these things would be investigated with emergency-type speed. But since GM has become such a very hot potato politically and economically, the government in the U.S. certainly sees GM as a driver of the economy, and there is huge money to be made in patenting our food supply and owning it. So you get these massive vested interests in keeping the GM food and feed supply going as fast as possible and not raising these questions about potential health risks. And one scientist in the U.S. actually said that the increasing problems in livestock health in America were being seen as a new norm, as he put it. So people just get used to seeing all these malformations, the fertility problems in livestock, the inflammation, and all the other problems that are increasingly being associated with GM feed. They just tend to get used to these problems as they creep in, and they think that this is somehow normal. Some farmers that have been noticing problems in their livestock actually are reluctant to speak out because they fear losing contracts with supermarkets and retailers. And farmers in general tend to keep quiet about problems anyway. So what we're seeing is a kind of public health crisis among humans and livestock as well. And everybody is frightened to look at the possible cause, because it may well be GM food, it may well be the glyphosate herbicide that most GMOs are grown with, and it may be both, but nobody wants to admit that.
Claire, I want to follow up with that. One of the more contentious debates today is whether or not it is possible for industrial GMO agriculture to coexist with traditional organic farming methods. And the big agri companies claim it is possible for them to coexist and that they don't interfere with farmers' freedoms of choice regarding the methods they want to use. However, this argument is fraught with many problems and uncertainties, such as genetic drift of GM pollen from neighboring farms that don't plant GMO. After all, birds fly and pick up the seeds of a genetically modified crop and then expel them onto an organic farm. That organic farmer now has a contaminated crop. So there's also the problem of uncontrolled drift of pesticides and herbicides, and there are classes where organic farmers have lost their organic status. Now, I'm a certified organic farmer. I've been teaching organic farming since 1972 and teaching sustainability and care for the earth. So I know that when a neighbor is using pesticides, those pesticides can drift right over, and there's a big concern about that, and yet people do not talk about this. And also, the small farmer, the organic farmer, generally tends a very small amount of crops. These huge industrial farms can be thousands of acres and use a lot of pesticides. So please lay out for us the argument given by Big Agra about coexistence of farming methods, and then deconstruct their argument for us. And then second, is it fair to say that Big Ag's denial of its threats to traditional and organic farms is intentional by design? I'm looking at Big Agra today much like we should have looked at big smoking, big tobacco, and some of the other major industries back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and we didn't. Is it a way to force farmers to use and rely upon GMOs and hence their chemical products as the sole means at their disposal for farming? And finally, what can you share about the growing number of incidences occurring of the discovery of unimproved GM crops growing in fields, meaning they have not been approved by anybody, like wheat, and yet here's genetically modified wheat growing where there shouldn't be any genetically modified anything growing? So GM Watch reported that the USDA has found over 700 violations of GM crop regulations since 2007, including 100 cases of release of unauthorized crops. And when you have a big storm, and I said this in the very beginning, let's say that you're planting a test GM crop in, let's say, Missouri. Well, what about the Missouri River when it floods? And we saw in the last 3 years, all of these major rivers are flooding, taking millions of tons of topsoil, including the GM crops that were experimental, and just washing them down the delta and onto other farmlands. Impossible then to find out where they're all at. Could you address these, please?
Yes, well, there's a lot of questions and a lot of points built into that, so if I forget anything, do bring me back to it at the end. Yes, the industry and the GMO lobby tries to suggest that we can grow a little bit of GM and a little bit of organic and a little bit of conventional farming all alongside each other, and nothing will go wrong and everything is fine, and they call this coexistence. And they've been lobbying for this in every continent all over the world. Unfortunately, 20 years of experience have told us that coexistence simply means contamination of non-GM and organic crops. There is a GM contamination register, which is maintained by some NGOs in the UK, but it's international in scope. And this records hundreds of cases of contamination from GM crops, of non-GM and organic crops. And let's not forget here that even though typically in most countries organic is a minority choice among shoppers, certainly the non-GM conventional food supply is the majority. And we shouldn't feel that somehow, you know, we need to defend our non-GM food supply, because it is by far the majority of the food supply at the moment. But increasingly what we see is that these GM crops are getting into non-GM crops, and markets are being completely ruined as a result. Already the Canadians have lost their flax export market to Europe because of contamination with a flax seed, a GM flax seed that was never actually grown commercially, I believe. It was approved, but the flax industry lobbied the Canadian government not to actually allow it to be grown because they thought it would ruin their markets. However, a genetic engineer actually gave out seeds to farmers and encouraged them to grow these seeds, which, of course, they did. Many of them didn't even know that they were GM seeds. And as a result, the Canadian flax seed market, the export market to Europe, collapsed, and it has never recovered since properly. Time and time again, we see this with other crops. The Hawaiian papaya industry has basically collapsed since their papayas became contaminated with GM. And one of the sources of contamination was just field trials. It wasn't even commercial growing. They were just very poorly controlled. Time and time again, we see that GM crops, which are only grown in so-called controlled field trials, actually they're uncontrolled and the contamination gets out. And this seems to be what's happened in the GM wheat case. GM wheat was found growing in a farmer's field in Oregon, I believe. And as a result, again, the markets were impacted. The Japanese and the Koreans actually ceased importing wheat from America for some time until the American government announced that there was no more contamination found. But I believe that now another GM wheat, which again was never approved, has been found growing in Montana. Again, this was a GM wheat which Monsanto field tested several years ago, and the field test ceased, but the GM wheat just kept growing. And it isn't always by cross-pollination. Sometimes it can be by inadvertent mixing of seeds after you've harvested the grains. So really anything can happen. What we see time and time again is that immediately a region starts growing GM crops, the non-GM crops do get contaminated. And the industry has ceased arguing now that contamination won't happen. Instead, they say, well, it happens, but it doesn't matter because GM crops are equivalent to the non-GM. There does seem to be a trend that contamination in some cases is actually deliberate. Certainly in South America with GM soy, Brazil was quite determined to keep the country non-GM with regard to soy, but there was so much GM soy being smuggled in over the border and planted by farmers because, of course, the farmers are just told, oh, this is a wonderful new miracle crop. It will produce higher yields. It's healthier. It will be easier for you to grow, and you'll make more money. So, of course, the farmers are just going to snap up these seeds and start planting them. In the end, there was so much GM contamination in Brazil that the president just had to legalize it. And the same thing, I believe, happened with cotton in India. The market was flooded with illicit BT insecticidal GM cotton. And very soon, the Indian government was just placed in this position of either, prosecuting every case of GM cotton growing or actually legalizing it. And, of course, the governments just choose the easy way and they legalize what's already happened. So I think that the food industry should not fool itself that you can have a little bit of GM and it somehow doesn't matter, and that we can keep the GM contamination out of non-GM food. That isn't what we see. And I think the pressure will creep in to allow larger and larger amounts of GM contamination in non-GM feed and food if we allow the GM plantings to go on expanding, and if we allow the industry to release an increasing number of GM crops.
That's Claire Robinson from London on Skype, and she is the research director of Earth Open Society, or Earth Open Source. And you can download for free GMO Myths and Truths at the earthopensource.org. And we also have Professor Michael Antonio. He is a leading molecular geneticist and head of the Nuclear Biology and Gene Expression Groups at King's College London School of Medicine. And he also was a postdoctoral research fellow at Tumor Biology Laboratory, University of Nebraska. Back to you, Michael. Why isn't it the U.S. government is not taking the challenges and risks of GM seeds and pesticides, particularly glyphosate, more seriously? Other countries, China and Russia, have. Russia recently has declared a ban on GMOs. The fact that China is taking the risks of glyphosate more seriously is especially telling, since China is the world's leading manufacturer of glyphosate. So why is the U.S. being so resistant towards these issues, which threaten the future of food safety and security?
Well, this is obviously the most important question in a way to ask. For me as a scientist, I see no scientific justification to the position being taken by industry and governments who are promoting GM cropping around the world. As a result, you have to try and find non-scientific reasons why they are doing this. And although I'm, you know, a scientist, I'm not a politician or an economist, but I see these two areas as really what the issue is all about. As Claire has already indicated, GM crops have become an economic and political entity and not just purely a technical issue. And that the vast amounts of money behind it are just driving it. And nobody involved wishes to compromise the finances involved here. And this is to our peril, because the evidence that low doses, long-term low-dose exposure to the pesticides associated with GMOs and other pesticides as well as the GMO per se, can be toxic. The increasing evidence that low doses of the pesticides associated with GMOs, as well as other pesticides, can have ill effects, especially through endocrine disruptive mechanisms, are just growing all the time. And if you ignore this, then we are putting current and future generations, the health of the current and future generations, at risk. And I just seriously hope that the regulators just sit up and take note. You know, I feel incredibly anxious, to be quite honest, about this issue, because it's something that is essentially affecting all of us. Nobody is immune from the effects of these products because they are so all pervasive. Even people that are on that are source organic and eat organic food all the time, at home and out away from home, you can still find residues of pesticides like glyphosate in their urine. Where is it coming from? It's because it's there in the environment in such large quantities that it's unavoidable. And even though it's low levels, the worrying thing is that these very low levels can still be highly toxic when consumed on a long-term basis through what we're beginning to understand as endocrine disruptive, hormone disruptive mechanisms. So this is the only conclusion really that I can come to, that what's driving things is not science, but other agendas, non-scientific agendas.
Well, let's take
and that is what's so worrying about it.
Michael, let's take a look at that a little more depth. A more recent study published in the British Journal of Nutrition looked at 350 studies comparing nutrient compositions between organic and non-organic vegetables and fruits, found that organic was 70% higher in antioxidants and far less in heavy metal contamination. Other studies have found other nutritional anomalies indicating the GMOs are equivalent to non-GMOs. Explain this further, but also before we get there, you mentioned about this is no longer about science, but in part it's about the politics of science. There are two classic examples, Dr. Cerellini and another a group of scientists in Scotland, independent scientists who did extensive research and came up with results that were really devastating, showing cancer in the animals and other abnormalities. And these people's reputations were just trashed. Their articles that are published in peer-reviewed journals, the journals were forced for political pressure to withdraw them, even though they were subsequently published elsewhere, and continued to maintain the same outcome. Talk about something you never see. In the normal course, if someone's doing a research on statin drugs or psychiatric drugs or COX-2 inhibiting anti-inflammatory drugs, they publish their results and it's the end of it and you go on. Suddenly, when someone publishes an article showing the dangers of GMOs, all hell breaks loose. And suddenly the persons lose their jobs, and these come from the top. In the case of the man in Scotland, it came from Tony Blair, Prime Minister of England. That's how he lost his job. We investigated and found that out. So talk about the danger of doing good independent science and being persecuted for the outcome.
Indeed, one of the most outrageous outcomes that we've seen within the GMO cropping arena has been the persecution of good independent scientists doing good independent work, and in all honesty and sincerity and publishing it in appropriate peer-reviewed journals, then subsequently being vilified and on a personal level, as well as their work being attacked and attempts made to discredit it, they then face these incredible personal attacks to discredit them as a scientist, even though they may have in well-established reputations being leaders in their field. It is what we're seeing here is something that's unprecedented, as far as I can tell, in the history of science, what we're seeing here in the GM crop evaluation area. And this is just reflective, in a way, of the fact that GM crops have gone beyond just technical issues, technical and scientific issues. They've entered into areas that, or what's driving them and what's influencing developments is just not science, being true to the science and the technology, but something other than that. And as I mentioned, the only conclusion I can come to is that it's the huge financial vested interest that is behind them that as a result drives these actions that rather than just allow science to take its normal course, as you said, you know, you publish a paper, people may agree with it or not agree with the results. You normally, what happens when you publish a study, it raises additional questions. And the way you go forward is that you build on that study with additional research and to see whether the hypotheses, additional issues that it raises are real or not, and whether there are genuine concerns there or not. I've never known any... That's the way science normally works. But when it comes to studies that are showing worrying results in terms of negative health impacts on the consumption of GMOs and their associated pesticides. For these, rather than things taking the normal scientific course of action, which is to say, oh, okay, there may be something, there may or may not be something wrong here. Let's do some more work to find out for certain. Where rather than that to occur, to simply attack the study and attack the scientists themselves, I've never known anything like that. And I don't think anybody in science has known anything like this to occur so vehemently during the history of science. And that is what is so distressing, because the health of animals and humans are being put at risk as a result, because the correct follow-up work simply isn't happening. The regulators are, for me, failing in their work to fully take on board the import of these studies and make sure that appropriate future investigations are conducted to get to the bottom of what's going on. At the moment, they're being dismissed as being somehow flawed. Okay, you may say the study is flawed, fine. Then commission a study which you think will therefore not have the flaws that you recognize, that you say are present in it. Commission another one, more appropriately designed, and let's see what the outcome is. That isn't happening. What we're seeing is a dismissal and business as usual situation. That's not science. That's something else.
It's the
call it what you want.
Yeah, I call it
political economics, whatever.
I call that the corporatization of science. Just as an aside for both you, Michael, and you, Claire, I spent 5 years with five other scientists, PhDs, NMDs, professors, Mount Sinai, Yale University background, top people in their field, and impeccable backgrounds, cumulatively hundreds of published articles in peer-reviewed journals. And we just ask a basic question, just one question. Is American medicine, as it's currently practiced, is it based upon science? It was that simple. And after 5 years of taking each segment of American science in medicine, like, because we call it medical science, we say oncology, psychiatry, rheumatology, you know, and each one of the different fields, cardiology, oncology, what we found was that there is not good quality science to substantiate the current performance of physicians, meaning the protocols of physicians are given to treat a patient based upon the symptoms the patient provides, the nature of their disease condition. The science is not there to say this is the best we can do. Now then, as an aside, we simply added up how many people die each year from the major different illnesses. And we found the number one cause of death and injury was iatrogenesis, or medically induced. And the Journal of the American Medical Association found that it was the third leading cause, but they were wrong because they did not include bed sores, which 88,000 people died in 1 year from bed sores, infections after post-surgery, which is common, thousands, and malnutrition that a person develops in hospital. Not they didn't have it, they got it in and died. 50,000 in 1 year. Mind you, 50,000 Americans died of 1 year of malnutrition they got from inside a hospital. So when you add the other factors of death in hospitals, it exceeded heart disease, a stroke, and cancer and diabetes. Had about the most conservative figure around 700,000. Now, based upon that, and we only use their figures, we only use their studies, we only used their reports, none other. There was nothing subjective. It was purely their studies. But no one had ever, to our surprise, collected all these together except a Harvard professor, and he found that there was 1 million deaths per year from medical improper medicine. And so then we went even further. We started looking at what determines a therapeutic model, meaning why do we choose a statin to treat elevated cholesterol, or why do we choose a chemotherapy for glioblastomas or some other form of cancer in the body? Why not some other therapy? And what we found was, and this was supported by Dr. Engel, the former, now Harvard professor, but former the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, she found that it depends upon who's doing the research. For example, if drug companies are doing the research, over 90% of the studies they do are going to be considered positive. But if it's independent research using the same protocols, it's a tiny fraction showing it's positive. But because of the power of the pharmaceutical industry to influence curriculums in medical school, to chair departments, to control advertising in medical journals and scientific journals, to control who sits on these advisory boards at the FDA and CDC and U.S. Public Health Service, National Institutes of Allergies, their own people, people with gross conflict of interest, sit on the board that decides should we use a drug or not. And we found that 90% of the people sitting on boards that say, yes, let's use this protocol, yes, this is safe and effective, are being financially benefited from the company that is product that will be sold. So you don't have in the United States today, you do not have independent science publishing in independent medical journals with physicians and who are allowed to examine carefully the best modality to use on a patient, whatever therapy they deem best. And you certainly do not have independent scientific boards in the halls of Washington, D.C. at every agency saying, we better take another look. This drug did not have benefit. This chemotherapy did not prove beneficial. And to cap off what I'm saying, I took one example. There's a Dr. Audier of Leiden University, and he found, and others found, there was also a Professor Abel, when he looked at over 3,000 independent studies or studies on cancer, that the vast majority, 80% of organic cancers, meaning lung cancer, brain cancer, pancreatic cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, stomach cancer, these did not show benefit. Not at all. None. Zero. Zip. None. To the contrary, they actually increased the risk of a secondary cancer or a loss of quality of life. So then the question he raised was, and this landmark article, why in the world are they using flawed therapies? And then he stated that it was because they believed in the therapy, so their belief in it, but no science behind it. But a lot of that belief has nothing to do with them. It has to do with the drug detail persons meeting with them, the continuing education seminars they're told, oh, use this, the propaganda, the ads, and then the idea that you don't want to break ranks because there could be a punishment and there's an incentive if you don't. So I use this only as an example of what's going on in medicine with devastating impact. And yet in food safety, we assume that we're playing with a completely clean slate of highly ethical, objective, and completely honorable men and women in science, medicine, and government bureaucracies to say we would never allow food that's unhealthy to be grown, sold, manufactured, processed. We would certainly tell you if there's such a risk was imminent to the public. And our science on this proves safety and efficacy. We would never allow the public to be used as human guinea pigs. And I'm finding that's simply not the case anywhere in science in the United States. You can't find me an unadulterated area of science in the United States. Wherever you put an argument forward, I will show you a counterbalancing argument that it has been compromised. So, sure. Michael, let's go to you first, and then I'd like Claire to add your thoughts on this.
Sure.
Well, I'm obviously, I find what you've just said shocking. Do I find it surprising? Not really, simply because of what we've seen happen to science over the decades, which is its overt commercialization. And I say that as somebody who doesn't fundamentally see anything wrong with industry academic collaborations. In fact, some of the best work that I've done over my academic career has been in collaboration with industrial partners, and we've worked towards common objectives, and we feel we've produced something that has led to products that have benefited in the clinic, in clinical use, and more so in the future. So when industry and academia come together with the right attitudes, I believe, and with the right agenda, knowing you've got a target and that you have to meet it by embracing all the safety issues, then it can work extremely well. But I think when the commercial imperative tips the balance, then I think this is where we see the kinds of outcomes that you've just described taking place. That's the only way I can account for these figures you just mentioned to me. You know, 80% of products that are being used for cancer treatment, actually the evidence shows that they're just not doing any good at all, and yet they're still being used. That is staggering. But it means that this, somewhere along the line, the system has failed completely. The objectivity of the evaluation system has completely failed, and something else has taken its place. And no doubt that, you know, probably that similar mindset is, for me, what we're also seeing occurring in the GMO food arena, where literally we are not being true to the science. And that's where fundamentally where the danger comes. And that is the science, I mean, both basic science, because the basic science foundation of all technological developments is a forever advancing foundation, which means that technologies have to be constantly reevaluated as a basic understanding of biological system advances and broadens. And something that may have been a good idea 10 years ago, based on our understanding of basic biological systems at that time, may not be a good idea anymore, because we now realize that, well, the technology may actually have an unacceptable disruptive effect, which we were unaware as a possibility 10 years ago, but now we have. And that's where we need to have the courage. We need to have the courage and also the responsibility to always be putting safety of environments, of animals and humans, ultimately humans, putting that as always at the forefront, and then having the being true to that science, and then having the courage to say, no, this is not a good idea anymore, not a good idea anymore, and it should just be banned, just taken out.
I wish that were the case. Thank you for your final thoughts here, Dr. Michael Antonio. I might mention before we go to Claire, Claire, you'll have 60 seconds to finalize your thoughts, that we sent our article to 7,000 medical scientific publications, including the USDA, the FDA, every governmental agency, every major medical and organization, and 5,000 members of the American Media Medical Writers, not one single response from a single human being. Mm. Your final thoughts, Claire?
Yeah, it doesn't, again, as Michael said, it's shocking, but it's not surprising. One of the things that's happened is that our so-called public research institutions have become very wedded to the GM model. They see money in it. They get grant money from corporations. The regulators also, you know, they've been approving these GM foods for years. They have a belief, and they are wedded to the belief that these things are safe. And they feel they cannot turn around, no matter what the evidence says, they can't turn around and say, whoops, we may have been wrong. Maybe they're not safe.
I appreciate those thoughts. That's Claire Robinson, and along with Professor Michael Antonio, both on Skype from the London, United Kingdom. The topic, the crimes of big agriculture. I thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.